From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer at the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dr. Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, doctor. Are you happy with the choices you made in education, Pope?
This is a long name for this show.
It is a long name.
Am I happy with the choices I made in education?
So today we're talking about choices in higher education. And so I want to know, are you happy where you ended up? Not in full life, but by the end of your college experience in a couple years past that.
Doing this show with you makes me so happy, Dan. So that's one choice, yes, I do not regret.
There was no choice in this.
There was no choice. You twisted my arm on this one. I am very happy. I'm a kind of glasses full optimistic person, so there's a lot of different things I probably could have been doing that I would have enjoyed just as much.
Really? So there's when you look back, there's not like some different choices you would have made if only you had had more information?
No, I mean, I think there – yeah, I would have definitely made some choices a little differently. I took some jobs during college and right after college that had I had a little bit more info or knew a little bit more, maybe I would have not taken. But those jobs helped to shape my decision to become a teacher and go into education. So for that, I'm grateful. I'm grateful for some of the zigs and the zags.
Wow. You're very optimistic.
I told you. I'm a glasses half full kind of person. So what about you? Can the same be said for you?
So I think most of my choices were made for me. So I actually wanted to go to Berkeley, and my parents wouldn't let me. So they sent me to a small liberal arts school. The only choice I made, now that I think about it, was I'm in my dorm room, and I'm talking to my roommate, and I'm saying, I want to take another math class. And he looks at me and says, oh, don't do that. You'll never use math again in your life. So I chose to stop taking math in college because of that, which I've regretted ever since.
Well, that's so interesting because I chose to stop taking math in college because after my one college math class, I was done. and I'm not going through that again. And then you get to graduate school. You have to take stats all over. But that's we had very different reasons for not taking math in undergrad.
So today we're going to be talking about people moving through higher education and the choices they make. And to help us, we have Mitchell Stevens, who's a professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Education. He's done research in online learning, higher education, the admissions process, and even homeschooling. His most recent book is Seeing the World, How U.S. Universities Make Knowledge in a Global Era. So welcome, Mitchell.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here.
So people don't think deans know what the faculty do. And the answer is, no, the deans know. They just sort of put it in their own language. So I'm going to try and summarize you.
Mitchell. I'm ready.
Okay, you're ready.
Summarizing his whole life right now in a sentence?
No, his scholarship. And then – depending on how far he lets me go, I'm going to start to satirize it. But we'll see how far we go.
I'll save you, Mitchell.
So to some extent, all your research has studied the movement of people through higher education. And so you've looked at key choice points along the way. Examples would be getting into college. You know, how are those decisions made and the admissions? A recent one that you've done where you've started collecting data about the courses that students take. You're now bringing that information back to the students to help them make choices about their courses. And so to some extent, your proposal is if we can get more information to people, they can make better choices through their pathways. You get yes or no?
You do not have to agree with that.
I'm cool with that.
So to go a little further, you believe that the bureaucratization is going to improve access and equity in education.
Funny you say bureaucratization.
Rationalization.
Typically has a frowny face connotation in contemporary life.
Rationalization.
But I'll take bureaucracy because 100 years ago, it was a smiley face idea. Societies created formal organizations to reduce uncertainty and ensure equality of treatment and opportunity. They created formal organizations to sort of manage the risks that came with chaos or non-organization. 100 years later, we tend to think that bureaucracy is a bad idea, but we tend to take the ones that work for granted. It's when they stop working or inhibit us rather than enable our movement that we begin to notice them.
Can you give an example of one that either is still working or one that stopped working?
Sure, absolutely. I give the example often to students of the subway system in New York City, which requires elaborate rationalization, rule following, routines. When the subways in New York work, the city is a magical place to live and work. When it fails to work, as it increasingly does at the moment, just how much we've relied on that system and taken it for granted in our lives becomes real. Another example is one of the reasons, frankly, I love working at Stanford is the bureaucratic systems at this university almost always work. We can take a lot of efficiency for granted
that
other organizations
can't. I'm busy working all night to make this stuff work.
This was not a kiss up to you, Dan, okay? Let me just make clear.
I'm just pointing out that everybody takes it for granted. Meanwhile, it's 4 a.m. and I'm sorting papers.
And I wanted to take this opportunity to thank Dan Schwartz personally.
Yeah. And Dan is Mitchell's boss. I'm just saying.
So you've looked a lot at, say, community college or getting into college or preparing people for the workforce and helping them make good decisions along the way. So pick a pain point and a possible solution.
Well, first I'll say that what I find so fascinating about universities is that they're very complex mechanisms. They do astrophysics, art history, football, and early childhood education simultaneously. And we somehow take for granted that an organization can and should be able to do all of those things. But a lot of the internal organization of universities is a black box. We take for granted that the experts know what they're doing, and we trust universities to an exceptional degree in comparison to other kinds of organizations. But inside that black box, there can be lots of pain points, specifically what we're working on now with a project at Stanford called CARTA is just how vast the choice sets are for men and women who are facing a curriculum at a university as rich an opportunity as Stanford. They can't possibly know what all of those options are or what the downstream consequences of choices that they make at this moment might be for their futures.
So say a little bit more about CARTA, because I know when I signed up for classes as an undergrad, we went to this huge room. We stood in line. And when it was our turn to get to the registrar, he or she opened up the book and they would say, this class is full, so you can't take that. Oh, you want it? Okay, so now we'll look at this one. You can take this. So totally different experience from when my college kids now sign up for courses, which is online, and they have all of this information that I didn't have. I had one book that I could study and look at and then stand in line.
Well, the U.S. academic system is unique in the world in the extent to which it allows and even obliges young men and women to make iterative choices once they enter college. In the U.S., we have this idea that we take for granted that students are supposed to enter a college and explore and iteratively investigate a range of courses and discover their passions as they find themselves. No other country on earth enables or encourages this kind of choice. In virtually all academic systems, men and women need to declare intended courses of study, and then they follow those courses of study pretty studiously. In the U.S., we take this open-sided choice for granted for lots of interesting reasons that we could talk about. But one of the things that it means is that, you know, I can only make choices that I know are available to me. I can't choose something that I don't know exists or something that I presume isn't right for me or something that I might presume I'm not able to do. And so the paradox of choice is that the more you give people, the more risk you also imbue them with facing.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Dr. Mitchell Stevens about higher education and choice and curriculum and this ability that we give to students who are 16, 17, 18 years old to somehow know what path to take.
So there's this is a bit of an aside, but there's a great study on choice where, in general, giving people choices, at least in the U.S., is highly motivating unless you're a perfectionist, and then it causes you anxiety.
That's right. And the university that we work at is full of people like that. In one sense, that's a kind of pain point or challenge. In other parts of the post-secondary sector, where the institutional resources aren't as deep as they are at Stanford, making uninformed choices can be seriously costly slow people down and hinder their timely progress. There's a lot of good research by Tom Bailey and others at Teachers College, Columbia University, demonstrating just how much time and effort gets expended in community colleges by men and women who are pursuing pathways that they don't fully understand the consequences of.
What's an example? There was a requirement that I didn't know I needed to take, and therefore I'm stuck with another year?
A great example would be a major like business accounting that is chronically oversubscribed. So I may choose a course of study in business accounting, take the first three courses, but not realize that the second three courses in the elective sequence are chronically understaffed and over-enrolled. Because I didn't know that when I made the major declaration, I may be halfway through a course of study, but the resources to enable me to finish aren't there.
Interesting. That's a lot. You need a counselor or somebody to solve this problem for students?
Yeah, you would think, back to our bureaucracy question, right? You would think that a rational organization would create clear scope and sequence and informed paths through colleges and universities. But we have this pesky tradition in the United States called faculty governance.
It is pesky.
We give individual faculty members and departments a great deal of discretion over what courses they offer, when they offer them, and sometimes even to whom. And so this allergy to centralized planning in academia means that 100 faculty members can create 100 different requirements in very complicated schedules, faculty are loath to give up their freedoms, and so that is what creates a lot of cul-de-sacs and narrowing pathways, not just in community colleges and large public institutions, but also at universities like our own.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with Dr. Mitchell Stevens about higher education and some pain points and whether or not the bureaucracy helps or hinders.
So tell a little bit about Carta and perhaps what some of the consequences.
Absolutely. And I have to say that Carta is hands down my favorite thing at Stanford University at present.
I
thought it was going to be you.
Computer science and social science. It is interdisciplinary. It is techie. It's a very simple web-based application. Anyone with an internet connection can look at a version of it at cartalab.stanford.edu. And it's a tool that aggregates information about Stanford courses that technically is already available to undergraduates, but is not made easy for them to access and maneuver without this tool. So it takes and the other thing is the platform was built in large measure by Stanford undergraduates. And about 90% of the students now use Carta on a weekly basis during the academic year voluntarily.
So it's just filled with Yelp reviews of courses?
No Yelp reviews whatsoever. Instead, it aggregates information from Stanford's official course evaluation system and provides summary statistics on how particular courses and, yes, particular instructors have been rated. It provides the most up-to-date information about course availability and scheduling, And perhaps most controversially, it aggregates grades of prior cohorts of students and provides those distributions in de-identified fashion to current Stanford students. So it has made a lot of open secrets, not secrets at all, in ways that have been very interesting to watch unfold.
So it turns out pottery actually is a very hard course, and people get C's.
It turns out that courses in engineering are the most difficult in terms of grades. It also turns out that the modal grade at Stanford is, in fact, an A minus. The fact that students at Stanford tend to get very high grades almost across the board is
it's
now
okay.
something
it's fair
that we now know about.
It's fair because the modal teacher rating is about an A minus.
Yes, so thanks heaven.
But there's
everybody's getting the benefits of inflation.
Yeah, there's talk about grade inflation everywhere in higher ed, right? So we're a part of that, or could you say that those students truly deserve those grades?
Well, I'm glad that you raised that point, Denise, because on my view, American academics don't really have any clear shared understanding of what a grade is supposed to do. Are grades supposed to be high, or are they supposed to be low? Are they rewards, or are they penalties?
Or are they my judgment as a teacher?
Do they represent my judgment as a teacher, or some sort of objective evaluation of a student or her academic work? Because we very rarely in higher education have those conversations explicitly. Just about everyone has an incentive to nudge the grades higher. The more A's I give, the fewer complaints I get as an instructor. The fewer men and women are knocking on my door, and I'm less likely to have students who are going to complain to others about the way I've evaluated.
So the law school here, I don't know if it still does it, but it used to be a forced curve that for every A a student got, another student got an F, and then they would post everybody's grades. It was sort of
what
very
do you mean
old
they would school. They would put your name. So and so got
you
an F.
You would find out what is your relative ranking compared to every other student.
Yeah.
So like I'm number two in the law school.
Well, they do that in a lot of other countries. I have had people from some Asian countries say to me, "Why don't you post rankings in K-12 education? These kids need to know where they are."
Right.
In the pecking order.
Well, I should say a little more about the reason I find CARTA so thrilling is that it's a fairly simple piece of technology, but it's beautifully designed. It did solve a problem that many students were facing, was that they wanted more systematic information about their courses than any human advisor, however competent, could provide. And it created a series of relationships between faculty and students and the advising staff that has really shaped the conversation about what we're trying to do with grades and evaluation at the university.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Mitchell Stevens talking about higher ed and grades and a program called CARTA next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Mitchell Stevens about higher education and about this thing called CARTA.
Right. So one of the big changes that's coming down the line for education is the amount of feedback and information going into the system from the student to the teacher, principals, all the way up. And so CARTA is a great example of this. I'm trying to understand, I as a student, how I use this. Does CARTA show me if I take this course, I've got these three different pathways, or is it really more I look at a course and I say, oh, look, everybody in this is getting an A. It happens to be in this sequence or satisfy this requirement, so I'll just take that course.
Yeah, in its simplest form, CARTA is a course planning tool that replaces the pen and paper that we all probably used when we were in college, and it makes it easier with a calendar function to place prospective courses into my prospective calendar and into a kind of parking lot where I can consider them. But it also gives me information about courses that other students took just prior to the course I'm considering and just after the course I'm considering. And what year in their academic career most students take this course. So I can develop some sense of where a particular field of study sort of might best fit in my own academic career. That's the sort of thing that one could do in theory without an interactive platform, but we can make all of those comparisons instantaneous.
It would be too hard. So this is really interesting where I'm trying to make choices in a prospective manner. You know, so like when I took courses, it was basically, do I want to take this course or do I want to take the history of Russian literature this year, or do I feel like taking a course on chocolate making?
It was just a whim. There was no rhyme or reason, is what you're saying, to your college career.
I don't believe I made any choice. All the choices I made were inconsequential.
Okay. And so it didn't matter whether you took chocolate or Russian lit.
And I didn't take courses with any view to like next year.
Uh-huh.
If there was a sequence that I had to go through, I assumed I would fall into it.
Your prefrontal cortex was not fully formed. That's not your fault. That's just all men, not till they're 28 or so. You can't predict what's going to happen.
Unfortunately, I think it never quite formed, and now it's on the decline years. So. Other nations have people choose vocational pathways.
Correct.
And is this sort of the end game? Is that we're going to enable people to say, oh, if you take this sequence of courses, you will end up being a lawyer? Or is that too far?
It's a great question because, again, Americans aren't quite sure who should be responsible for people's occupational careers. At selective institutions like Stanford, we explicitly presume that the student herself should be in the driver's seat and make those choices as she moves through the time and place of college. But as soon as she graduates, her future is not scaffolded in nearly the same way that it is at a university. And we all face increasing recognition that our sons and daughters are going to have to make multiple career shifts throughout the entire course of their lives. And so we're trying to figure out whether the uncertainty and contingency of higher education is a good thing in that it prepares people for uncertainty and decision-making going forward, or if it might under-equip them for expertise in particular fields of work.
What's your vote?
Well, how much do you handhold is a question for parents all the way through their kids' childhood. How much do I step in? How much do I let them make these mistakes? How much should it be their decision? And if they mess up?
I mean, I sort of – and I'm seeing if I can map this to the college case. I would block really bad decisions. But in terms of direction, I wouldn't interfere.
We're not paying all this money for you to go to that little liberal arts school to take chocolate making, Dan. Would you wish someone blocked you from –
from chocolate making? It was my favorite course. Every Friday night I have friends over for chocolate. No, I'm kidding.
Well, in fact, that's why a four-year college degree is such a powerful kind of lifetime insurance, because once men and women complete that milestone, a great deal of the uncertainty that they face in labor markets historically is reduced.
Because you have a college degree.
Because you have a college degree, regardless of how much chocolate making there was inside of it.
Uh-huh. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Mitchell Stevens about higher ed and now its relation to future career choices.
Mitchell, you're saying that it is showing that you got the degree that's the key.
Yeah. Historically, the possession of the four-year degree was what the sociologist Mike Hout calls a milestone in the life course, that it kind of washes out other forms of disadvantage that men and women had earlier in their lives and enables them to enter the labor market in competition with otherwise many more privileged people. However, there's a lot growing uncertainty about the extent to which that signal is retaining its integrity and power.
So, in other words, is it still worth it to get the four-year degree?
Everybody wants one.
everybody wants one, but how much should it cost? Who should be providing it? Are some of them better than others? Yes. And is a minor in chocolate making okay?
Yes.
Those are the kinds of questions that, frankly, parents all over the country are increasingly asking, because they're being asked to shoulder more and more of the financial responsibility for that education. And there are new competing forms of certifications and credentials that didn't exist half a generation ago.
Right. I mean, if you can go and get a coding degree in 2 years, do you have to pay all that money to be a computer science major from Stanford? I mean, people are really grappling with this right now.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I have my opinions, but but they're not evidence-based.
Well, should we ask the expert his opinion on this?
Mitchell?
Well, a degree from a highly selective college or university, there's no question that it retains its power in the labor market. And to frame it a radically different way, elite higher education also shapes marriage markets, so that men and women may not fall in love with the people they went to college with. But they are highly likely to fall in love with people who went to comparably prestigious colleges and universities, and to use not only amount of education, but where one went to school as a way of sorting and selecting potential partners. So it really matters. At the same time, those branded degrees are extraordinarily expensive, and they're increasingly difficult to be admitted to. So there's a great deal of fertility, especially out here in Silicon Valley, on creating sort of new forms of educational opportunity and new forms of connecting school and work.
So in 20 years, are people going to be going to college?
Oh, there will continue to be college. It's just not clear how big that tent is going to be. One of my favorite comparisons is in the 1950s and 60s, Americans decided that a whole new class of institutions, community colleges, were college too. They were specifically vocationally focused. They weren't focused primarily on four-year degrees. They didn't necessarily lead to white-collar jobs. But we called those institutions colleges, and they now proudly serve the majority of Americans. What will the next forms of college that Americans create in the next 5 to 15 years look and feel like? How big will that tent be? And what role will places like Stanford play in that ever-expanding ecology?
Thank you, Mitchell, for coming. And thank you, all of you, for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes, and on SoundCloud.